Morning, in the matter of State versus Williamson, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Morning, Your Honors. Allison Perrone, First Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Mr. Williamson.
Morning, Your Honors. Matthew Troiano from the law firm of Einhorn Barbarito on behalf of Amicus ACDL of New Jersey.
Your Honors, Barbara Rosenkrantz for the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jennifer Kamisiak, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Attorney General.
Thank you, counsel, and good morning. Ms. Perrone, please proceed.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Your Honors, fine declarations have been referred to by legal scholars as a fossil and as the laughingstock of the hearsay exceptions. This exception was created based on unfounded spiritual assumptions and has been continued as a matter of tradition without any basis in science or fact or logic. Here, the trial court erred in relying upon this hearsay justification to admit a dying declaration of the victim's identification of the defendant that was made at the hospital 6 hours after she had been shot and 11 months before she died. There's two reasons why the supposed dying declaration in this case was inadmissible. The first is that it does not satisfy the requirements for admission as a dying declaration under the evidence rule. And the second is that regardless of whether it satisfies the requirements of the evidentiary rule, its admission violated defendant's constitutional right to confrontation. And the second argument consists of two parts. One, that the confrontation clause does apply to dying declarations, and two, that the dying declaration in this case was a testimonial statement, triggering the protections of the confrontation clause. Regarding the first argument that this dying declaration was inadmissible under our evidence rules, the hearsay for dying declarations is, not surprisingly, very narrowly drawn.
Ms. Perrone, who says they're unfounded? Where's the evidence that they're unfounded, that people do not believe that they should speak the truth? Is there some article on that? Is there some empirical evidence? Who says they're unfounded?
Ron, I would submit it's actually the opposite, that it's not founded by any type of study. It's not based on science. There's absolutely no evidence to support an assumption that every single person would respond that way to dying.
What type of evidence would that be that would support your position?
I don't think such evidence exists because I don't think there's no evidence that people would respond a certain way when they're dying. There's no evidence to support that people would be afraid of God at the point that they're dying, or that they would all of a sudden no longer be feeling whatever worldly motivation they had to lie in the first place. So for instance, if someone wanted to lie to take the blame off themselves, or they wanted to lie to implicate someone else, there's no evidence anywhere that would suggest that those motivations would no longer exist.
Is there any evidence that they would not support that position, that they would not be more truthful? Is there any evidence to the contrary, was my question to you, other than your supposed statement that they don't, that there's no evidence that they would? Is there any evidence that they would not follow that?
There's not specific evidence that they would not, Your Honor. It's that it's a proposition that the admission of these statements is based on, and that proposition is not supported by anything.
Counsel, are you suggesting that this court has the authority to reconstruct or actually abandon the dying declaration rule, aside from the Constitution? Forget about the confrontation clause. Are you, because I'm trying to figure out where this argument is going.
So the first part of the argument in terms of just the evidentiary rule, not the confrontation clause, is not that the court necessarily abandoned the dying declaration exception, but that it certainly enforced the very narrowly drawn admission requirement for it. That if there isn't even a very strong basis or perhaps no basis in law for this exception in the first place, then at the very least, the court needs to very strictly apply the imminence of impending death requirement that's in the rule.
Should we carry that on to the excited utterance? Is there any evidence that when people are excited, they are more likely to tell the truth than not? Is there any evidence that supports that proposition? So should we do it with that one also?
I don't believe that there is any evidence to support that one.
So is your position we should do away with that exception also?
I don't, you know, I'm not making that argument today. I would have
Ms. Prone, I know you started your argument with a broadside attack against the rule and pretty broad and strong rhetoric that relates to that. Why don't we focus on the issue that's in front of the court instead? Beginning with the evidentiary rule here, does it apply under the facts? And if not, why not? We have a situation where an individual was shot multiple times, whose heart stopped, was in critical condition, was told that she could die, and responded to the information that she receives from the doctor with tears. What's missing?
So, Your Honor, what's missing is that an imminent belief in death has to mean more than a general awareness that one has life-threatening injuries. We don't dispute she certainly had life-threatening injuries, very, very serious injuries. She certainly reacted emotionally when she was told about those injuries. It's unclear whether her tears in her eyes was at the time period that she was told what her injuries were, or at the time period that she was told that she could die. That's not clear from the record at all. But
how about the fact that she was told her heart had stopped? Isn't that pretty significant for somebody to hear that their heart had already stopped?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And if she had given her supposed diet declaration at the scene, right before her heart stopped, it would be a different argument, but it wasn't. It was 6 hours later after she was admitted to the hospital. Her heart obviously had been restarted. She was told she was receiving medication and that she had a breathing tube to assist her in breathing. So
did she know that she had been shot 11 times, that her spine had been severed at the neck, and that she had been told by her doctor that she could die? All before the police officers questioned her, did all those things occur?
Yes, she knew that she had been shot. She knew that she was a paraplegic. She knew she was in very serious medical condition. All of those, though, do not equate to a belief in imminent death. Did she believe that she could die? I would imagine that she probably did. I think there's a very...
So what is your definition of imminence? Within a couple seconds, a couple minutes, and is an hour, not a, maybe an hour or two, you may die? I'm trying to figure, what's your construct for the term imminence?
I don't think that there's a specific cutoff in terms of a time period. I think you look at all the surrounding circumstances, one of the most important being whether the person is stabilized or not. Because if they're not stabilized, if this happens at the scene, if it's more the traditional type of thing that you think of for dying declaration, someone lying on the ground at the scene, gasping for their last breath of air, that's certainly imminent. On the other end of the spectrum, we have what happened here, which is 6 hours later after she received treatment for very serious injuries, but she did receive treatment. She had woken up, which the doctor found significant, and she was stabilized.
She was stabilized, but she, in the interim, had received some very dire news from her doctor, which is that she could die. Also, that her condition with respect to the paraplegia, and she got all bad news from her doctors in that 6 hours. Her awareness, if you compare her awareness to the extent she was able to respond at the scene, which from what I can tell, she couldn't have, but her awareness at the scene may not have been of death as imminent as much as her awareness when her doctor tells her very very plainly that she may die. So what, again, you know, what more could there be than this in terms of an imminent fear of death?
Again, Your Honor, I would submit that it's the lack of imminence. She knew she could die. She did not know that death was imminent. She did not know that she was at death's door. When you read the language in the cases that talk about admitting dying declarations, it's very strong language. It's that the person is certain that their doom is near, that they are not going to survive. And it makes sense that we need this critical limiting principle. This case being an example, she She was told that she could die because of her injuries. And she did in fact die because of her injuries, but it was imminent death has to mean more than a general awareness. It requires a belief that one will imminently succumb to those injuries. And this case really provides an illustration of that concept, which is this victim certainly knew that she could die. And in fact, she did eventually die 11 months later. But I don't think that anyone could legitimately argue that for this 11 month period, while she knew that she could die, that anything she said during that period of time would have been a dying declaration. And that's why the limiting principle is so rigid. They must have spoken with a consciousness of a swift and certain doom, must believe that one will imminently succumb to their injuries.
But we're not talking about sometime within 11 months. We're talking about in the immediate hours after the victim was shot 11 times within the few hours after she was told that she could die, intubated, spine severed, and it's just a belief in reasonable belief in the imminence. Doesn't mean she's going to die. A belief that she may die at any point. Why isn't that satisfied here?
Because, Your Honor, although it's not required that she die immediately, she must believe that she is immediately going to die, that her death is imminent.
Can we infer that from the circumstances as a general proposition? Can we infer that knowledge as a general proposition from the circumstances?
I don't think so. I think that someone in her position knew she was extremely seriously injured, but she also knew that she was at the hospital, that she had been put on a breathing tube, that she had been given medication to stabilize herself. And 6 hours later, she was still alive and stable. She had woken up, and it can't be inferred from those facts that she believed that her death was imminent. She may
have. Dr. Barone had told her that she could die. Those are difficult words to hear when you're lying in that condition, reacting. And remember, the rule is based upon the declarant's state of mind, not the objective reasonableness of how imminent death is. So these are powerful influences that she's subjected to right now in that hospital that you're saying she's stable. I think that's a generous view of her condition at that point.
Jenna, again, being told that you could die, I'm sure that was very, very terrifying. And she certainly, I would imagine, would have believed at that moment that her death was possible. That's different than her death being imminent. And I think it's a really important limiting principle that has to be applied in this.
Don't you think it's very powerful that her doctor told her that? Do you think it's frequent that someone's in the emergency room responding to the trauma that she just went through and hearing the words from her physician that you may die? That doesn't happen very often. Wouldn't you agree?
I would imagine it doesn't. And I would say it was significant. But I would say that when she's still alive 6 hours later, she's received treatment, she is on a breathing tube, she's not in any immediate distress.
A breathing tube, she was intubated, which is extremely painful. This is not a very comfortable position that she was in at all. So I don't think that should be minimized.
Not at all, Your Honor. And I'm not attempting to minimize these injuries. They were extremely serious injuries. I'm sure it was very painful. But the very narrow question about whether she believed that she was imminently going to die, I would submit that that the factors that we look at to determine what her subjective state of mind was doesn't support that conclusion.
You would agree that there will seldom be a case where a doctor would say, your death is imminent, right?
I would agree with that. And I don't think that—
Placing the facts from this case to one side for a moment, I want to clarify the back and forth we had a little earlier. is it appropriate to infer from the circumstances what her state of mind was?
I think we have to infer from the circumstances what her
and state so our and so there may well be a disagreement as to whether the facts satisfy your understanding of imminence, but they are what they are.
I think we can infer from the facts whether the definition of imminence is satisfied. And we know that the definition of imminence is very narrow. We know from the past cases that talk about dying declarations and they use such strong language, the entire premise of allowing these dying declarations is the idea that the person is about to die in that moment, that they wouldn't lie because they don't want to die with a lie on their lips, that they wouldn't die because they're afraid, they're so certain that they're going to go see a higher power that they're afraid to tell a lie at that moment.
So one other factor that should be obvious, she's suffering at this moment, she's suffering quadriplegia. I don't think she's suffering any pain. She has no feeling. This woman is intubated, has been told you may die, has no feeling in her toes, no feeling in her fingers, can't move any part of her body. So does this also go to probably the terror in his state of mind based upon that condition? And then in addition, what the doctor has told her?
It may in fact go to terror in her state of mind, but terror in her state of mind isn't the standard that we're looking at. We're looking at whether she believed that she was imminently within those moments going to die, which she had been alive for the last 6 hours in the hospital receiving treatment. It's very different than the typical type of dying declaration scenario that you see where someone immediately after being injured sort of utters their last words.
You would agree. Again, counsel, in these circumstances, you know, as was already discussed, it's rarely the case, it's pretty common knowledge, it's rarely the case that a doctor will tell someone you could die. So she's being told, your heart already stopped once, you're quadriplegic, you've been shot 11 times and you could die. I mean, isn't it reasonable to infer from those factors that she really did think that she was imminently going to die? Again, it's very rare that a doctor will tell you you could die and also deliver all the information with regard to her really serious condition, including the fact that your heart has already stopped once. So, I mean, isn't that reasonable here to infer that that was her state of mind, that she was imminently going to die?
Well, again, she was told about very serious injuries. She was told that she was a quadriplegic, which would not necessarily have anything to do with dying.
So she's also told that her heart stopped. That certainly has to do with dying.
Correct.
And that already had happened.
But her heart had been started again, and she was at the hospital receiving treatment. And my point is just not that she wasn't seriously injured, not that she might not die, but that there is a difference between 6 hours later, after having received medical treatment and being told that you could die, but that's remarkably different.
Isn't that sufficient? The rule says you believe you're in death is imminent. Not that it is or it isn't, not that you've been told or confirmed, but whether you believe it. So when you have someone on an emergency room table being told these things, isn't it reasonable to believe that your death is imminent? Because that's all the rule requires. It's belief in the imminence of death, not that you're in death is imminent.
I agree with that. It's her subjective belief. And maybe if at the moment when she had first arrived at the hospital, maybe that would have been a different situation, but it wasn't when she first arrived at the hospital. It was six.
She was unconscious. You agree she was unconscious for a period of time after she first arrived at the hospital, correct?
Correct.
It wasn't 6 hours after the shooting. It was maybe 3 or 4. I don't know how long before she started to become coherent, but there were a few hours when she was still unconscious, correct?
Yes, she was shot at 1 o'clock. She was brought to the hospital. At 2:30, she was taken for a CT scan. And when she came back from the CT scan around 3 o'clock, she was conscious and awake
And also, does it matter that the same doctor that said you could die, I believe he testified that in her condition, in her critically ill condition in the emergency room, that means that death, a person critically ill is at imminent risk of death. In other words, there was some objective medical testimony that in fact, she was in imminent risk of death. Was there not?
The doctor did parrot that language using the phrase imminent risk of death, but when she testified, the doctor did that. But we're looking at what the victim believed.
Well, I understood, and that's what everybody's emphasizing, but you also had evidence the trial court had to consider in making a determination about her state of mind that, yeah, in fact, somebody in that kind of grave condition shot, and also, unlike some in that condition, shot 11 times, intubated, no feeling from the neck down, told you might die, is indeed in imminent risk of death. Is that, does that play into it at all?
No, the doctor's belief that that satisfied the definition of imminent death doesn't play into it. That was testimony the doctor gave at the hearing, had nothing to do with what the victim was told by the doctor. We need to look at the circumstances surrounding what the victim knew. And what the victim was told was that she could die. And my position is that is significantly, from a legal perspective, significantly different than being told that she would die or that death was imminent.
Ms. Perron, would you like to move on to the Confrontation Clause argument?
And, yes, Your Honor.
And respond as well, if you would, to the argument that this was not raised at the trial court level and not fully raised at the appellate level either. Please go ahead.
The Confrontation Clause argument, Your Honor, was put before the trial judge, then was not specifically raised in the appellate division. I would submit that it's not waived basically for two reasons. Number one, that the admissibility of this statement, whether it's phrased as Confrontation Clause or evidentiary rule, was the primary issue in this case from the beginning. And in fact, the appellate division ruled on the Confrontation Clause argument. And then this court granted certification, and in the certification grant specifically stated that one of the issues it was granting certification on was the Confrontation Clause issue. So I would submit that there is not waiver under those circumstances. With regard to the Confrontation Clause argument, the suggestion that dying declarations should be somewhat immune from the Confrontation Clause simply because they've been around for a long time, it doesn't make sense. The two main justifications, as I discussed, for admitting dying declarations is that they're inherently reliable because a person wouldn't lie on their deathbed, and that they should be admitted due to necessity. And both of those reasons fail to justify a runaround around the Confrontation Clause. So the inherent reliability argument fails for two reasons. First, Crawford has abandoned the reliability analysis. Under Crawford, it's not left for courts or evidence rules to designate certain types of statements as inherently reliable and therefore exempt from the Confrontation Clause. And there's no degree under Crawford, there's no degree of proof of reliability that can render a testimonial statement admissible. The right to confrontation means the right to cross-examination. So even if dying declarations were inherently reliable, which I submit they are not, reliability is immaterial if the opportunity for cross-examination doesn't. But
are you relying on Crawford? Because if you are, then you have to embrace Crawford, because Crawford was doing a historical originalist analysis of the Confrontation Clause. Are you accepting that?
Yes. For the,
okay, so if you're doing that, then you also have to acknowledge Justice Scalia's footnote when he's doing his historical analysis, where he says, and I'm quoting, the one deviation we have found involves dying declarations. The existence of that exception is a general rule of criminal hearsay, cannot be disputed. And what he was saying, and what we know, is at the time of the adoption of the Confrontation Clause in 1791, the dying declaration was very much a part of our common law. Yes?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And so the question is whether or not the people who drafted the Confrontation Clause were intended to extinguish the dying declaration. And Justice Scalia did not find any historical basis to come to that conclusion. which is a reason for his footnote. Am I mistaken?
That's correct, Your Honor. The issue has never been squarely decided by the United States Supreme Court, but the footnote in Crawford and the suggestion later in Giles that there could be an exception for the confrontation clause for dying declarations. Yes, that exists.
Doesn't Giles go, give us a little bit more guidance than that, though, Ms. Perrone, because it did rely on the prior existence of forfeiture by wrongdoing as something the founding fathers would have been aware of and known about when the Sixth Amendment was being drafted. They allowed that to continue, notwithstanding the Confrontation Clause otherwise requirements.
They did, Your Honor, but the court emphasized that it was making that decision based on equitable grounds, which really distinguishes that from the dying declaration. The court was very clear that its position on forfeiture by wrongdoing was that someone should not benefit from contesting their lack of ability to cross-examine if they caused the inability to cross-examine.
They may have said that, but they were still carving out from an otherwise constitutional imperative the existence of a well-established common law exception to the hearsay rule, right?
They were. That's correct, Your Honor.
So that principle is one that may translate to this setting as well, could it not?
I submit that it does not, because the justifications that exist for forfeiture by wrongdoing are stronger than the justifications that exist for a dying declaration. And so even though the Supreme Court has definitely left open the door, the possibility, for, and in fact, courts across the country are interpreting the footnote in Crawford and the language in Giles as meaning that dying declarations are exempt from the Confrontation Clause, my argument is that I'm urging this court not to do that. And that's where it comes, the argument that I was making earlier about the lack of support, the lack of any kind of reason or logic underlying the Confrontation Clause, that that's not something we can ignore.
Can we ignore the decisions from the United States Supreme Court from the 1890s that had no problem applying dying declaration in Carver and Maddox? Are they now called into question?
Well, no, I think our Confrontation Clause jurisprudence has evolved. Our understanding of the ideas below underlying a dying declaration have evolved. The notion that people are also inherently religious, that they wouldn't die on their deathbed, that notion has changed. Medical science has changed. And basically, the ideas underlying a dying declaration exception are antiquated. It's an antiquated notion. It's not based on any science, and it's basically just made up. And the idea that we should continue doing it because it was done 300 years ago in a very different society under very different
circumstances. One can call it made up. One can also call it common sense. Could they not?
I would disagree respectfully, Your Honor. I think different people are going to react different ways in terms of at their death. Some people, maybe because of a religious reason, would not lie. Other people, for whatever reason, might not lie. But there's no basis to assume that if a person had a motivation to lie, that motivation is suddenly gone at the time that they're about to die.
But that is our rule right now. And this is what I'm trying to understand. You're embracing Crawford. Crawford is a historical originalist interpretation of our Constitution. And part of that originalist construct takes into account like what common law rules pre-existed the Confrontation Clause and were acceptable to the drafters of the Bill of Rights. Now, the Dying Declaration was there. Many other exceptions to the hearsay rule were developed after 1791, and therefore it's easy to cast them aside. But the Dying Declaration is in a completely different category, and our court and the legislature and the governor through the Evidence Rule Act of 1960 have adopted this particular exception. So I'm trying to understand, you know, you want to take one part of history and you want to like ignore another part of history. Why don't you explain that?
I understand your position, Your Honor, about Crawford being based on an originalist interpretation. And Crawford is the law. So that is the law, that reliability or inherent notions of reliability cannot save something from the right to confrontation. I submit that that doesn't mean that the court has to go to the next level and blindly accept adherence to a concept that's antiquated, outdated, and not based on science. And I would...
So if that's the case, and I'm not... Isn't the appropriate approach to move to have that piece of our exception to the hearsay rule eliminated? And there's a process for that. I mean, the legislature under the Evidence Rule of Act can remove it. This court can make us adopt a rule that would remove it, submit it to the legislature. I mean, there's a process for that. We're not there though. That's a different issue.
Right. I certainly would agree that that would be an appropriate thing to do. But for this defendant and for this case, I'm not asking the court to go that far. I'm asking the court to apply the confrontation clause to the dying declaration, just like the court would do if this were an excited utterance. The idea that the statement could come in for confrontation reasons under one and not the other, just because the other was around longer, it doesn't make any sense.
What proof is there that excited utterance is any different? It's a belief that person will not lie or enhance something or minimize something because it's excited. There's no evidence. There's no scientific evidence of that. How about Honor, 3C5, statements for medical treatment? Many people don't tell the doctors the truth. They don't tell them that they're eating the wrong foods. They don't tell them that they have dizzy spells. So should we take that one out too?
Well, that's why, Your Honor,
people don't lie to doctors. I mean, as a matter of fact, a lot of people don't tell the doctors the whole truth when they're being diagnosed, so they don't have to do different medications and stuff. So should we do away with that one too?
The difference, Your Honor, with those exceptions is that those are all subject to the confrontation clause. And the idea to carve out dying declarations is something that's exempt from the confrontation clause, to say that the defendant isn't allowed to explore the type of reasons that you just pointed out, when the defendant would be able to explore those in other situations, that doesn't make sense.
They're still admissible, whether they're explored or not. And if that's the case, then wouldn't most of the hearsay exceptions fail if you can't produce someone? Is it part of the purpose of the hearsay rule to allow statements in that can't be proven otherwise?
But it's always subject to the confront. Well,
not always.
The exception of dying declarations, it's always subject to the confrontation clause. And so a testimonial statement that comes in
not necessary. 803C is about witnesses are unavailable.
But John,
if they're unavailable, I suspect that they're not going to meet the confrontation clause, are they?
I'm sorry?
If they're unavailable, I suspect that they will not meet the confrontation clause requirements. It's 803C specifically about unavailable witnesses.
Correct. So these,
if they're unavailable, how are they going to satisfy the confrontation clause? They're not there to be cross-examined.
They don't. And so those statements would not be admissible.
All those should, the entire 803C section should come out?
No, Your Honor, that it's subject to confrontation though. So if it is a testimonial statement, then it's going to be barred by Crawford. And that's not something that I'm asking the court to do. That's established law. And what I'm asking the court to do is don't carve out an exception for dying declarations. They should be subject to Crawford just as any other hearsay would be.
I think we have your position, Ms. Perona. Is there anything you'd like to add at this point?
Your Honor, I just wanted to very briefly make the argument in response to the state's argument that this was a testimonial statement. And just because if it's a testimonial statement, that's a prerequisite to the confrontation clause being applied. And just very briefly, at the time that this victim made the identification, it was 6 hours after the offense. There was no ongoing emergency at that point. The defendant had already been identified as a suspect. The police had already gone, obtained a photograph of the defendant, brought it to the hospital, asked the witness to make an identification, and then recorded that identification. And so under these circumstances, it's clear that this was a testimonial statement, not a statement made in an ongoing emergency.
Thank you, Ms. Perron. We'll have you back for rebuttal. Mr. Troiano, and ask you to incorporate any arguments that you adopt as your own. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And I apologize again for the
not to worry.
Technological issue. Judge, if I may, and thank you again, the first argument that I would make is with regard to the dying declaration. And what I think we would all concede that Ms. Bell had significant and serious injuries, ultimately lost her life because of those. But the issue I would submit to Your Honor is that the state failed to, in essence, bridge the gap in the proofs that they provided during the course of the hearing to go from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the time that the statement was taken. The last evidence, essentially, that was given with regard to her medical condition was at 3 when Dr. Kunick testified that she got back from a CAT scan, became able to communicate, and there was communication between the two of them. There was no information that was provided by the state from 3 on. The only information that was provided was the testimony of the detective, and the detective didn't testify that he said anything to Ms. Bell with regard to her condition. So the state's failure to bridge that gap should not benefit from that, quite frankly. They had the opportunity to make an appropriate record and they didn't. So when the trial court judge and the appellate division reviewed the record, they relied just on, certainly on the basis of her injuries, but the basis of her injuries 4 hours prior to the time that the statement was taken. And the analysis is whether or not the declarant believed in the imminence of her impending death at the time that she gave the statement. And quite frankly, there just was not any proof with regard to that. There could have been, and there wasn't. So with that in mind, and I know Justice LaVecchia obviously took issue with the notion of her being stable. The injuries were very severe, but the fact of the matter was, is that she showed improvement as time went on. Her condition at the scene, her condition upon entry to the hospital, and then thereafter, it continued to improve. So the state should have been obligated to establish her condition and the inferences you could draw from that at the time that she gave the statement, and they didn't. And for those reasons, it should fail under the dying declaration. With regard to the testimonial nature of the statement, I would submit to Your Honor that the expansion of the definition of a testimonial statement would be huge in this case, in the event that this court were to determine that what was done here was non-testimonial in nature. As Ms. Perron said, the police officers knew who they believed the suspect to be. They had canvassed the area, they had spoken to witnesses, they had spoken to the defendant's father, they had the time to go down to the police department to obtain a photograph. They took a video recorded statement from her. All of those are support of the notion that this was testimonial in nature. And when compared to other cases, I think that is clear.
Mr. Troiano,
yes, Your Honor.
If the court follows the logic of what appears in footnote 6 in Crawford that Justice Albin read earlier, do we have to address the question of whether this was testimonial?
Well, I would address that two ways, Judge. Number one is that, obviously, I think that this court could look at it from the viewpoint of the state constitution. And what does Your Honor and this court want to allow with regard to these confrontation clause questions? And I would submit to you that if you look at some of the other areas that this court has deviated from the Supreme Court, this would be an opportunity to do so, certainly. I do not think, and I agree with Ms. Perron, that what is an antiquated theory of what somebody, how they may act at the time of their death should control. A question was posed early on about whether or not there's any proof to support that somebody would act this way. This morning, I had the benefit of watching the statement which was submitted of Ms. Bell, the video. It's a little bit different when you watch it in video rather than read the cold record, because she is asked some questions, I would submit to your honors, that she, I would say, hedges in her answers. One specifically about potentially the circumstances that were going on that day, whether or not there might have been an argument. You could tell that her responses differ at that point than the other responses of, did you know who this person was? Were you familiar with him? That in and of itself is a clear record to me that she was contemplating what her answers were going to be and was not just making responses from this religious notion of I need to tell the truth. So I would submit to your honor that it shouldn't just be controlling. I don't think that this court should permit a blanket exception to the confrontation clause just because of the historical nature of a dying declaration. So no, I do not think it should control.
But you like Crawford, right? You do like Crawford. And Crawford was a historical interpretation. I mean, it wound up reversing decades and decades of jurisprudence by going back a couple hundred years and figuring out what the drafters intended by the confrontation clause.
I figured
you'd like it, but so
I do like it.
The historical interpretation of the confrontation clause is good for defining testimonial statements. Like, why isn't it also good for determining, like, what did the drafters intend in 1791, and then our drafters also in 1776 Constitution didn't have a confrontation clause, but 1844, they would have been aware of the dying declaration as well. Like, where is there at least in the historical record to suggest that the people who adopted the confrontation clause wanted to just do away with the dying declaration?
Well, Judge, I don't think that the question is, and I could be missing it, and I apologize. I don't think the question is so much, should we do away with the dying declaration exception to hearsay? I don't think that has been suggested. I would say, bluntly, prove it. You know, you could continue with the exception, but if you are going to continue with it, then you have to prove its admissibility. And I think that the state, on my first point, I think that the state failed to do that here because of the failure to bridge the gap. So I'm not suggesting that we should just do away. That's a question for another day, but I'm not suggesting that. If it is proven, and this court has recently, Justice Solomon in Prahl discussed the individual who was on fire, and there was an analysis of whether or not that should be admissible into evidence, but nobody's suggesting, or at least I'm not suggesting, that it should go away. It should just be proven, and it was not proven here. In response to your question, do I agree with Crawford and the testimonial analysis? I certainly do. I think that the clear dividing line should be, is it testimonial or is it not testimonial? Your Honor has issued opinions with regard to that, and I think that they're important. And in this case, if this court were to decide the testimonial nature of this statement and determine that it's testimonial, I would submit that it would be a vast expansion of how to define that and have adverse repercussions for similarly situated defendants.
Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Trejano?
No, Judge, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Rosenkranz.
Your Honors, the victim's trauma unit identification of the defendant as her shooter, made 6 hours after she had basically been brought back to life, was a dying declaration. The victim was in critical condition at that time, and that was defined as meaning an imminent risk of death. And that's borne out on the July 27th, 2016 transcript, page 40, lines 11 through 13. No one had told her of a different diagnosis at the time she made the identification. Deference must be given to the trial court's ruling that death hovered over this victim when she made the identification. She knew she could die. She knew she could not breathe on her own. She knew she was quadriplegic. And she also knew that her heart had stopped and had to be restarted. And her eyes teared when she learned of her grave injuries, showing that she knew that death was likely near. The appellate division correctly ruled that a person in the victim's condition would have feared imminent death. Also, the defendant has waived his right to argue that admission of the identification violated the confrontation clause. He did not raise the issue on direct appeal. Also, admission of dying declarations is consistent with the confrontation clause. The Sixth Amendment creates a preference for live testimony, not a demand for it. Exceptions to the right of confrontation that existed at the time the Sixth Amendment was ratified, and one of those exceptions were dying declarations, were incorporated into the Sixth Amendment. There are good reasons that are just as valid today as they were centuries ago for this: reliability and necessity. As for reliability, for many reasons, many secular, not necessarily religious, the prospect of death looming compels a person to be truthful. A person believing he is facing his final hours on earth likely ponders the important things in life, such as family and friends and making amends for wrongdoing. If dealing with a wicked person whose final desire is revenge, well, the remedy is to admit the revenge evidence. In short, the remedy is to impeach the dying declaration, not bar it. As for necessity, there is often no other evidence of the homicide. This is real life, not a CSI show, where an enterprising officer magically uncovers watertight evidence of the defendant's skill. The victim's testimony is lost forever because he is dead, not because some devious prosecutor plotted to use a substitute for live testimony to thwart defendant's ability to cross-examine. A defendant demanding live testimony is asking the impossible and symbolizes chutzpah. Also, the victim's identification was non-testimonial. True, the defendant's identity was known, but the police could not twiddle their thumbs. No one knew where the defendant was. No one knew where the gun was. And no one knew the defendant's motive, whether it was a private dispute with the victim and he just wanted to hunt her down, or whether he wanted to hunt others down, especially the witnesses who saw this shooting in broad daylight at a housing complex. Thank you.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Kamisiak.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Given the discussion this morning, I have 3 points I would like to make on the hearsay issue and then 2 points on the confrontation clause. So first on the hearsay issue, the defense, Ms. Perrone and Mr. Troiano both have talked about this victim in various ways being stabilized. And I just want to, for the record, point out that there is no evidence that at 7 p.m. when the investigators were at the victim's bedside that she was stabilized. Actually, the record supports the opposite. And this is at 2T when the emergency room doctor is testifying, starting at page 39. And the doctor is actually shown the videotape that the detective took at 7 p.m. And the doctor explains that we hear beeping in the background. That's the ventilator that's actually keeping the victim alive. And the doctor testifies that at that moment, the victim still is objectively at imminent risk of death. So there's no support for this idea that she had somehow stabilized. And I just wanted to highlight and clarify that for the court's convenience. Second, with respect to this issue of the doctor telling the victim that she could die, the court has indicated some members of the court found that significant, and the Attorney General also finds that very significant. And it seems that the defense position would be that the doctor has to tell the victim that you will die. We do not feel that in any way is a realistic standard. And I would just point to two examples from the case law that show why that cannot be the standard. It's not a realistic standard. And in State v. Brown, it's a North Carolina case from the North Carolina Supreme Court. And there the doctor actually lied to the victim, a burn victim, and said, I think you're going to be all right. And there the court still found that it was a dying declaration by looking at all of the surrounding circumstances. Here, we don't even have the doctor lying to the victim or really sugarcoating it. She tells the victim, you could die. And the Attorney General finds that very significant. And we also have the Lester case, which we discussed in our brief. And there the doctor also testified that he did not want to tell the victim that his prognosis was death because that would create a barrier between them. And the third point I wanted to make on the hearsay issue is just about how the objective medical evidence can be used in the analysis. It certainly can be used. The Attorney General agrees that the standard is subjectively the declarant's state of mind, but the objective medical evidence can certainly be used in circumstantially reaching what the victim's subjective state of mind was. And this is discussed in State v. Hagel. And we would urge the court to adopt the Hagel factors that were in the appellate division's opinion in that case. We think those factors make sense and really help to flesh out the analysis. Those are the factors that the judge in this case looked at, and those are the factors that the appellate division also looked at as well. And moving on to the confrontation clause issue.
Before we do that, Ms. Kaminsky, can I just ask you a question? I didn't have a chance to take a look at the advisory committee's notes when the our rules were being updated. Hagel is mentioned. Do you know to any degree that was considered when dying declaration was continued in the evidence rules, the Hagel factors?
I don't, unfortunately, Your Honor, have the answer to that question.
Okay, thank you.
But I do know that Hagel was relied on here, and Hagel is relied on in other states as well. And it seems to be an appropriate analysis for looking at circumstantial evidence of the declarant's state of mind. And with respect to the Confrontation Clause issue, it's already been discussed that we have footnote 6 in Crawford, we have the Giles discussion. And I just wanted to also bring to the court's attention, because it's more recent, in Ohio v. Clark, the United States Supreme Court also has some language that further supports the position that dying declarations could be an exception and should be deemed an exception to the Crawford analysis. And this is at 576 U.S. 246 to 247. And there, the United States Supreme Court specifically cited Giles for the proposition that the Confrontation Clause does not prohibit out-of-court statements that would have been admissible in a criminal case at the time of the founding. And then the court also cites, again, footnote 6 of Crawford. So we have at least three Supreme Court cases that have recognized, starting with Crawford itself, that dying declarations do not really come within the analysis. And we also have, as we laid out in our brief, 19 appellate courts that have reached that same conclusion based on looking at Crawford alone or Crawford and Giles. And I just wanted to address the suggestion that by Mr. Troiano that perhaps this court should deviate under our state constitution. And I would say that this court should not. It should continue in the tradition that it always has done. In State v. Roach, this court said that the federal and state provisions provide equivalent protection, and this court should continue on that course. And then my last point would be to respond to a question that the Chief Justice asked, whether if this court finds that it is an exception to that dying declarations are an exception to the Confrontation Clause, do you need to reach the question of whether it is testimonial or not in this case? And I would submit that you do not. I would point the court to People v. Monteroso, which is the California case that was one of the leading cases in finding that this is that dying declarations are an exception. And in a footnote, the court there specifically said they were not reaching the question of whether it was testimonial or non-testimonial. We certainly rely on our brief if the court feels differently as to the fact that it was a non-testimonial statement in this case, but the court really does not even need to reach that question. Unless the court has any other questions, we would ask that the decision of the appellate division be affirmed.
I just have one question.
Sure.
If we would adopt your argument that we that footnote six was the original intent of the drafters of the Bill of Rights, and it wouldn't make a difference if it was testimonial. The exception would be sweeping in testimonial statements, correct?
Absolutely, because the footnote says that many dying declarations may in fact be non-testimonial, but there is authority for admitting even those that are. So the footnote itself makes clear that you don't even need to reach that issue.
Thank you, Ms. Kmisiak. Ms. Perrone, brief rebuttal.
Honors, I waive rebuttal unless the court has any questions.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. Thank you, counsel, for the fine argument.